This is November 4th, 1997, and we are talking to Ed Mayo. Ed, tell me a little bit about when you came to Houston and how you became involved with the museum.
I came to Houston in my mother's womb.
You were born here?
I lived in the house I was born in. And that was in 1918, and how much detail do you want? I'll tell you how I came to the museum. I think that's the best thing.
Yeah, that's important.
James Tillman Jr., as he was known, was the first director of the Museum of Fine Arts, founding director. He was also a professor of architecture at the Rice Ben Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the teachers who knew me when I studied architecture at Rice. I graduated just in time to be drafted into World War II, which relieved me of the necessity of trying to be an architect for at least 3 years. Came out of the Army Air Force and went to work for an architect with whom I worked for 6.5 years, learning what I knew to begin with, that I really did not have architectural talent and had too much respect for the, I hate to call it an art, but too much respect for architecture to be another bad one. They had plenty of bad ones around already. They didn't need any more. So I floundered around and did a number of other things. And finally, the gentleman who noticed this floundering, this is now in the latter part of 1960, asked me if I wouldn't like to come to work at the museum as the registrar. I think I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Well, I have a book here. If you will come to work, you can read the book and learn how to be a registrar." And he offered me a little bit more money than I was making where I was. You can see how little that must be, because the museum didn't have any money, really. And I went to work there on January the 15th, 1961. About the same time as he hired me, he was the interim director. He had been director emeritus when Lee Malone became the director of the museum. Really, the first full-time museum director was Lee Malone. Mr. Tillman never considered himself full-time director because he had what he felt was the full-time job at Rice. But he devoted as much time as almost any other director, surely the next couple, at the museum. And he and Miss Euler and one janitor kept the museum going by themselves, three people during World War II. When he left and took the title of Director Emeritus, he was gone about, I guess, 4 or 5 years when Lee Malone was there. Lee Malone resigned, and Tillman came back as interim director, and he was there a couple of years while the board searched for and found a new director, James Johnson Sweeney. So we were both hired about the same time. Mr. Sweeney did not hire me, but I will tell you, he is an experience that I shall absolutely never forget. I think I remember more about it than I do about any of the subsequent directors, though every one of the directors I had memorable characteristics and were very much very, very different in many ways from each other. Peter Marzio said once, "We shouldn't think about how they were different. We should think about how they might be the same." But, well, I've never approached from that point of view. Well, I'll try. And I did. And I found out that they did have one very, very salient characteristic in common, and that was that they were all dedicated to art, each in his own very individual way. But it made working there probably a lot more interesting than working for just one person. Sweeney was, I think he felt that he was probably charged by those who hired him with putting the Museum of Fine Arts of Houston, as it was officially known, still is. And he really kind of picked it up by the nape of its neck and turned it around. In doing so, because of his own particular interest, it became better known in the broad aspect of museum world as an almost modern museum.
What was James Sweeney like to work for?
I had not very much experience working for individuals, and I probably never knew an individual like Sweeney. I don't think there was an individual like Sweeney. It was a very stimulating experience. We were told that when he was hired, he was given the opportunity to do whatever he wanted with the staff. He had the notorious reputation of having fired, if not all, 99 and 44 and hundredths of a percent of the staff at the Guggenheim when he went there. He once later explained why that had to be done. He could get rid of anybody at the museum. There weren't too many people to keep or get rid of when he came, except for Miss Ruth Hewlett. She was of a sacrifice. She had the patronage and the respect of a number of people, and particularly of Miss Nina Cullinan, who was on the board at that time and had been before and was on the board long after that. But Sweeney didn't fire anybody when he came. He augmented the staff a little bit, not a great deal, because what money he was given, I think he felt that, and maybe had been told that it was for, you know, acquisitions. That was the money that he had to add to the collection. And he added to the collection by some very fortuitous gifts, mostly from Mr. and Mrs. Menil, and then he bought things. He bought contemporary art. He may have bought some tribal art, as we then called it, tribal art. Mm-hmm. What do we call it now?
Primitive.
Well, we called it primitive art then. Now we call it tribal, or maybe subsequently some other terms. But he didn't have much money for exhibitions. He didn't have much money for staff. He wanted to really do it himself. He felt quite able to do. He didn't hire any curators. He didn't want any curators. He didn't have a businessman. He got rid of one by dint of the constant battering on him. So the man finally resigned. And he was an extremely strong personality and a very, very interesting one.
Mm-hmm. And then, so who followed Sweeney?
Sweeney was followed by Mary Buxton.
Oh, that's right.
Mary Buxton was there when Sweeney came. She was docent coordinator. Her salary was paid by the Junior League. I've forgotten how long Mary was there. She was there a long time. And when Sweeney left, I presume it was Cy Morris, who was president of the board at the time, and the board put her in charge because of her educational background, or lack of it. We never would even call her acting director. She was called administrator. Mary had a lot of very good things going for her. I'll tell you, if you can't be anything else, be born beautiful. And she was a very good-looking woman with an unbelievably charming personality, smart in the head. She's from Georgia, and she had gone to the University of Wisconsin. Her name was Mary Hancock. In her Georgia days, she married Mr. Weaver and had two children. By the time I knew her, she had shed Mr. Weaver and had married Fred Buxton, prominent, and became more prominent as a landscape architect in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
She was Mary Buxton for many years, and a lot of people still think of her that way. So now she is Mary Kane. But she took care of museum business for about 2 years while another director was being chosen, who turned out to be Philippe de Montebello. His first name was Guy Philippe Ron de Montebello. One of his progenitors was the famous Napoleonic Marshal Ron. His great-great-great-grandfather, I believe he said. And his friends in New York, where he had been a curator in the Department of Paintings at the Metropolitan, all called him Guy. When he came south, he dropped Guy. He said, "Those people down there, they won't call it that way. They will call me Guy."
Christ.
So he was Philippe. And everybody, of course, called him Philippe, except Mrs. Delaneel, who had the same sort of Gallic antecedents. And let's see, I guess the first one he hired probably was E.A. Carmine,
mm-hmm.
who is now director of the Books Gallery in Memphis, Tennessee. E.A. stayed at the Museum of Fine Arts until Bill Agee came, and his area of expertise and Bill's particular interests were overlapped a lot. So he, I think, felt there's no reason to stay here, particularly when he had a chance to go to the National Gallery in Washington as their first curator of 20th century art. He was the Museum of Fine Arts' first curator of 20th century art in his time at the museum. If I remember correctly, the next curator that Philippe hired was Jack Schroeder. Jack Schroeder, I think, was not too long out of a graduate program. I think it was Princeton. He was from Kansas, and he had his undergraduate work at the University of Kansas, and his specialty was medieval art. When did he leave? He left the museum before the Montebello left and went to the Metropolitan also.
Hmm.
He was, I think, called a curator of the cloisters, or director of the cloisters. Not really, not the curator of medieval art, but it was specifically concerned with the cloisters.
What's the museum like under the Montebello?
The Montebello was a great pleasure for me to work with. First of all, he had really had no experience as a director, and he wasn't the curator of painting at the Met. He was a curator in the department of. Now, how exactly he got here, I'm not positive. I probably never have known, but it was through the good offices of John A. Beck.
So John Beck helped to bring him down.
He did. How exactly he did, I do not know. There was some probably intermediary, maybe social connection. I'm not quite sure about that. But one Saturday at home, I had a call from Cy Morris, and he said, will you meet John Beck Sunday morning at the museum? He is bringing Philippe to Montebello. I think we might have known that Philippe had been hired at that time. A little hazy in my memory now, whether he knew it or whether he was here looking over the place, but he wanted to see the storage of things at the museum that were not on view. And that was my introduction to him. Also my introduction to John Beck. I knew who John was, but I don't think I'd ever met him before that.
Well, so the Montebello, was he an intense person? Was he highly focused? I mean, what was his charge for the museum?
One of the first things, I think that he really felt, and I think the directors felt, that it's time to get rid of the Sweeney image. The Sweeney image was too modern, and we need to get back to the basics, old masters. So that is where he focused his attention and what acquisition funds he had. He bought a lot of things. They were not, you know, great old masters, but they're very solid additions to the collection of the museum. When he first came, Ann Holmes interviewed him. They took a picture of Philippe, I think maybe by himself, in front of the museum, the William Ward Watkins building, the south neoclassic facade. And She, I think, asked him about two sculptures, two sort of orbs, bronze orbs, that were on each side, one each on each side of the opening on the south entrance. That space, I don't know what it was called before Sweeney came, but he dubbed it the South Garden, and that's what it says. And the gallery inside, which used to be called the Foyer, Sweeney dubbed South Garden Gallery, and that's what it stayed for a long time until it became the Lovett Galleries.
Uh-huh.
And that was under the remodeling at the time that the last Mies edition, the Brown Pavilion, was built.
Mm-hmm.
But what question Anne put to Philippe, I don't know, but he put his foot right in his mouth. He said, "You can consider me a royalist. I wish the French Revolution had never happened." And that sort of set the tone. That set a barrier he had to overcome. I really enjoyed working for him greatly.
Uh-huh.
I said he did not have great experience. He had no experience as a director, but he had a lot of savvy. I guess it's maybe just French savvy. I'm not sure what it was. And he was a bright, he was a smart man. He was, you know, Harvard educated. He learned Russian while he was at Harvard. He took a conducted one of the museum tours to St. Petersburg, or then Leningrad and Moscow, and he, I think, acted as an interpreter along the way. He also went to Krakow. I remember because he sent me a postcard. I must have known that in Krakow was one of my favorite paintings in the whole world that I have never and probably never will see, by Leonardo, called The Lady with the Ermine.
Tell me the Malandello lesson, then. Did Aichi come in then?
Aichi came, yes.
Right after the Malandello.
Yes, yeah. And I don't believe that there was anybody. I don't think the time was so great in between that there had to be somebody.
Now, wait a minute. Was McClanahan in there as an interim?
McClanahan was...
Or was he just ahead of the board?
No, no. He didn't become a salaried personage until Phil was there.
Phil was there?
Yeah.
Right.
And McClanahan was made president of the museum. See, he had been president of the board before that. He became president of the museum, and he was a salaried person. He was there for
not long.
2 years. And when he left, he said, "Well, I've accomplished what I came to do." Whether or not he did, we're not absolutely sure. But everybody who worked at the museum pretty much idolized McClanahan. That is staff. None of his predecessors, except perhaps Mr. Sweeney, and there weren't any hired hands really for Sweeney to talk to. McClanahan knew everybody and knew them by name and spoke to everybody on the staff.
Very gracious.
And the other directors didn't know their names, didn't really care, I don't think.
Why did the board put him in there? What was the purpose?
Well, only thing I can remember specifically was what Mrs. Brown said once. This is after his presence had become a known irritant to A.G. We sent him over to be helpful to you all. And I think there was doubt in the board that A.G. could administer. A.G. was a wonderful art person. I don't think anybody there has been any better, or maybe even in many ways come up to him as an art person.
He knew his field.
And he knew a lot of other things, too. He got his undergraduate degree at Princeton. In fact, I believe he played basketball for Princeton. You know, Bill was very tall, 6'2", I believe, maybe taller. And then he got his master's degree at Yale. He did not have a PhD. In fact, we never had a PhD director until Dr. Marzio came. But Phil was hampered by the onerous task absolutely imperative in administering. Administration was not something that he enjoyed. No. And he met lots of roadblocks in the art community. Why exactly? I'm not sure. Because he of all people was dedicated to the more recent art than any of the others. You know, he's a teacher, a full-time teacher.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a hunter.
Nothing.
Hunter. And I think thoroughly enjoys it as well. And probably is an extremely good teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But as a speaker, not quite. The Montebello spoke quite well. He was a good speaker, very good. Sweeney was tended to be an esoteric speaker.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes over the heads of his normal audience in Houston.
I don't think Peter speaks that much. I mean, I don't hear him do a lot of speaking.
Right.
I have one thing to recommend if you want to know how Peter thinks and can speak. Got a copy of his commencement address at the University of St. Thomas of 95. It's the best speech I ever heard him make, and of course it wasn't. It was aimed at the students, you know, the graduates. St. Thomas gave him an honorary degree at that time, and it was. I'd never heard him give that kind of a talk, and I made a point of going, and I'm extremely glad that I did go. And I know that it's in writing because I got a copy of it from his secretary afterwards.
Right. Tell me one of the more interesting experiences that you had during the time at the museum, receiving them, or was something that happened that was funny or different or precarious or difficult?
Probably it's the thing that comes to mind first. It comes to mind quickly now because somebody asked me recently about how long the Olmec head stayed on the lawn of Cullinan Hall. Sweeney did an exhibition called the Olmec. But what really punctuated the whole show was the Olmec head. It was a 15-ton, I don't know what it's called, La Venta head, but it came, you know, from that part of Mexico. It had been found half submerged in the earth. It was on its side. And who found it, I've forgotten. It's all in the catalog. He did a catalog for that exhibition. And he went to Mexico. It's in the sort of the Veracruz region. I believe that's where all those heads came from. The head stayed out on its grassy mound for almost a year. Finally, one summer, after Sweeney, as was his usual wont, arranged the museum the way he wanted it, and he took off for Ireland and was gone about 2 months. And during that time, a telephone call came from the State Department in Washington asking where the head was. We have heard from our embassy in Mexico City that the Mexican government wants the head back. It needs to be installed in the new anthropology museum. It was in the point of near completion, and it had to be installed before certain other things were done. I happened to get the call because I think I was, as I said, this is before the staff had become very much enlarged. I don't know whether Miss Euler was there or not. She was such a surrogate for the directors in her time. She was really more than that. But it was up to me to to decide what to do. I'm trying to remember exactly what I did do. I had no authority to say, well, we'll pack it up and send it back. So I knew that that was the only thing that could be done. I probably consulted with whoever was the president of the board. It might have been Cy Morris, and he was there two times, I believe. It might have been him. Anyway, what was decided was, yes, no, pack it up. Well, packing up a 15-ton sculpture is not the easiest thing in the world. Now, it had been crated in Mexico under the direction of, I believe, a German engineer who was there. And he built a wonderful crate for it, made out of steel I-beams.
Did you keep it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, we kept it. Kept it in a storage warehouse someplace. So the proper people were alerted, and the grassy mound was demolished. It sat there on this sort of precariously on this concrete block. The foundation has been poured for it. And it was packed up, carted to the port, put aboard a Mexican ship, and sent back to, I think it was the port of Veracruz. We heard later that it sat on the docks in Veracruz until the president of Mexico had issued an order to move it to the Anthropology Museum in Mexico City. There was a fine highway apparently between Veracruz and Mexico City, and they had to put it on a flatbed truck and take it. But they hadn't moved it because they said, well, it didn't have an export license.
Now, Ed, tell me, in your perspective, how does the visual art seem to you in comparison to the last 30 or 40 years, 50 years? What do you think has happened to this city? Do you think there's been good progress?
It's phenomenal progress. Phenomenal. You know, in 45, let's see, was we have to consider Ben Dubose here, because Ben Dubose was really the first person that did anything about providing a venue for the exhibition of contemporary artists, local artists, except the Museum of Fine Arts.
Right.
For like 32 years or 33 years, the museum had an exhibition called the Houston Artist Exhibition,
right,
which Sweeney put an end to, much to the distress of Houston artists, some of whom have never forgiven Sweeney for doing that. But it was not only a place for them to show their work, it was the only place of any significance.
They sold it, too. It was for sale also.
And every year, there was a purchase price. And that collection remains intact. So far, it's not been touched.
Did the museum purchase the winning
yes,
painting each year?
Yes, each year. And that gave an overview of the period.
How many years do you think that was, Ed?
About 33 years.
So there's 33 paintings on it.
Well, I can't remember when the Texas Artist Exhibition started, but it was going on in my time, and it lasted a little bit longer than Houston because Houston wasn't in control of it. It was held each year in conjunction with the Texas State Fair in Dallas, and the exhibition was exhibited there first, and then in Houston and San Antonio. I've forgotten in which order. And the museum continued to acquire works from that exhibition. There was a purchase price there also, until Sweeney stopped acquiring works, but he didn't stop giving money to the exhibition. He just didn't want what he had to offer. I think he felt, as he did, I'm sure, when he took the O's out of the title, the Museum of Fine Arts of Houston,
he took that out
and put a comma.
Sweeney did that.
He did it. So, as far as I know, by himself. Mr. Sweeney was a one-man band in many ways.